Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American power, politics and prejudices. The election is over, but the Americano never stops and there will be a lot to talk about with the second Trump administration. And so we'll bring you more and more Americano because judging from the feedback, that's what you guys want. So please keep listening. Hello and welcome to this, the last Americano of 2024. It's been one hell of a year in American politics and America as a country and society as well. And we have covered it all from the very beginning of the year to now, the end of December, as we approach the end of December, around Christmas now we are. This time last year, I think it was December 20th last year, I spoke to Victor Davis Hanson, who is a brilliant scholar, a classicist, a conservative commentator, and the author most recently of a book called The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. And Victor is joining us here. Victor, last year, I think the headline of our podcast was Will America Descend into Civil War? And you were not that gloomy. You said you didn't think that America would descend into civil war, but we were having a sort of realistic discussion about whether that could happen. I think it's fair to say, from your point of view, certainly from your recent writings, the mood music in America has changed. Has it changed?
Yeah, and it's not my view alone. The data shows that it has. This was the first election since 2004 in which a Republican won the popular vote. It was an overwhelming electoral college vote. The Republicans come into power with control of the White House, the House of Representatives, the Senate, the Supreme Court. Here in blue state California, five counties flipped from blue to red. And Kamala Harris did much more poorly than Joe Biden did in this overwhelmingly blue state. But more importantly, all of the issues that became signature controversies on the part of the Trump campaign, they were calling for a closed border. They were calling for a deterrent foreign policy, sort of a Jacksonian, neither isolationist nor neoconservative interventionist. They were calling for full blast energy development. They were really looking at deportations of 12 million people, many of them who've already had been ordered to be deported, almost 1.5 million, and have resisted that. Crime, etc. And they were also counter-revolutionaries. They made it a point to suggest that traditional views of gender rather than the transgender chauvinism, an end to DEI, racial preferences on the preferences based on your superficial appearance. So it was a totality of issues, and they all polled about 55 to 60%, and that's what I think helped Trump run to victory.
And is it a relief that the madness that you've just described has been defeated? And I think it's fair to say that a majority of Americans regarded the Democratic mindset as a bit mad and off-putting. So is it relief or is it actual excitement about what Trump might do in the second term?
Well, as you know, when you have these revolutionary ideas, after 4 years, they can become institutionalized. So then the pushback against the abnormal becomes in itself abnormal. So on the theory that you let in 12 million people illegally and you have 600 jurisdictions that are basically neo-Confederate, they're saying that federal law does not apply within their districts. And then you question that after 4 or 5 years of that, and longer in the case of sanctuary jurisdictions, then people get, he's a radical. If you stop the wall when he's built 500, repaired 500 miles, then he wants to do the next 1,500. He's a revolutionary. It's extremist. If you say we're not going to hire on the basis of race, he's a racist. And I think that's a sign that whatever this madness was, this Jacobin revolution, and it wasn't confined to the United States. It affected Britain and its former Commonwealth countries, and it affected the EU. But United States, while when it adopts change, it does so more radically and more quickly because of the nature of our government and culture. And it's going to be very difficult to overturn that, but I think it's going to be very acrimonious. And you can see it with his appointees. He's picked people that the traditional establishment is terrified of, or they think that it's abhorrent to them. And the reason, one of the reasons he's picked a Pete Hegseth or RFK or Tulsi Gabbard or Jay Bhattacharya is that he's deliberately, Kash Patel, selected individuals that have been victims of the very agencies in which they're now tasked to reform. So Kash Patel was surveilled unlawfully by the FBI. Tulsi Gabbard was put on a terrorist watch list, essentially, for flying. RFK was demonized by HHS bureaucrats for years. Jay Bhattacharya, who will run the NIH, was censored by the Stanford Medical School and the campus that I'm on, the Stanford Faculty Senate, unapologetically so. So this idea of a counter-revolution in Trump's mind is it won't work if he has the same mindset of 2016, that he's a novice, that he comes in, that he taps a Rex Tillerson, a Jim Mattis, a John Bolton, the existing uniparty professional class, because he feels that they will leak to the New York Times, or in the case of Anonymous or Mr. Vindman, they will actively try to destroy his administration from within and will be heralded for that by the media.
I can see what you're saying there, and I can see that it's an attractive proposition for people in Trump's orbit to send in these figures who have suffered at the hands of the, or have a vengeance, a mission to lead the departments that they have suffered from. But I tend towards the gloomy, and I tend to think these sort of revolutionary thoughts tend to fail, and counter-revolutionary things tend to fail. And I, you know, agree with Enoch Powell's assessment that all political lives end in failure. Do you think that Donald Trump's political life will end in failure?
I think he has a 50-50 chance because he is not the catalyst. He is riding, he's an epiphenomenon. He's riding a crest of previous reaction and outrage. And how do I define that? He was called by his own party a racist, serially, insidiously, and yet he got a higher percentage of the Hispanic vote than any other Republican president, almost 45% and higher among Hispanic males, a majority. He got 25 to 30% of Black males, maybe 16% of the Black vote. That's unheard of for a Republican. So he, as part of this movement, racial and ethnic chauvinism was starting to erode before a common class solidarity. So Trump was saying, I can feel this movement that a Black truck driver, a white electrician, a Hispanic concrete layer all have more in common than they do with their elite, Joy Reid, MSNBC, or professor of ethnic studies. And I'm going to capture that and make it ecumenical. That was different. We haven't seen that as a counter-revolutionary movement, but that presage, or excuse me, that I think that you could say that was there. I don't know if it was an active movement. Trump defined it and crystallized it, but that surge was there. The other thing that was important is he wasn't running in a vacuum. When I say that he picked people who had been victimized, the people who were the victimizers were generally not liked. So Anthony Fauci, the more that we learn about his role with the pharmaceutical companies, gain of function, circulating money stealthily to Peter Daszak, he had a prime role, I think most people would acknowledge, in helping the gain of function virology lab in Wuhan birth the virus. And when you look at Rex Tillerson, or you look at James Comey or Andrew McCabe, the heads of the FBI, they had both lied under oath. Comey pled amnesia 245 times. Inspector General found that Andrew McCabe lied 4 times. And the same thing is true of the head of the CIA, John Brennan, the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. I could go on, but you get the impression that he's getting these eccentric, individualist, weird people to go in there, and there's a pushback. Well, they're not qualified by traditional criteria, but the majority of the country looks what they are opposed to and said, something is wrong. These universities, the Claudine Gays in the world, they've institutionalized anti-Semitism. The political class is corrupt. They lie with impunity. The Biden family is corrupt. And I think there's evidence to warrant that. And then they look at the media and they say, look at a pollster right before the Iowa election. She says that Trump is going to lose Iowa. That's absurd. He won it by 13 points. MSNBC, CBS, all of the network news, PBS, have either deliberately misinterpreted facts or created them. 51 intelligence authorities, we were told, swore that Hunter's laptop was Russian disinformation, Russian collusion, etc. So what he's saying is the traditional CVs, the traditional resumes, the traditional res gestae of this class is what got us into the pullout and the humiliation in Afghanistan, or the absurdity of handing over $50 billion in weaponry, or pressuring Israel when it's done more to take out Hezbollah, Hamas, and weaken Iran than we ever have. And so he's running against something that's very unpopular. And I think that's another reason. Everybody thinks he's creating this counter-revolution. No, he's riding the crest of it. And that's why he's very careful. They think he's in control and he's a free actor. There are very careful parameters that he understands what he can and what he cannot do. And he's facing a number of paradoxes that are going to be very difficult. When he says in a pop to this base, you shouldn't have to pay taxes on tips. You shouldn't, military people should not have to pay taxes. People on Social Security, when he does this, he's reducing revenue by $1 trillion in aggregate. And yet we're running a $2 trillion deficit, and yet he's going to balance the budget. So that's going to require historic and massive cuts. But the more that he says that he's going to be a MAGA tax cutter for the middle class, the more he bumps up against his own advocacy for physical discipline. The more that he says he's going to restore deterrence when it's been completely shattered, as you know, the only way to restore deterrence is when people call your bluff. You'll have to use some force. If you use some force, his base will say, well, you may be a Jacksonian, but you're using an optional use and you're going to get us into an endless war. And the same thing about these appointments that are so controversial. The MAGA people say, well, these people are completely discredited the existing status quo, so we need an alternate cast that has been victimized. But in many cases, they don't have the experience and the expertise and the knowledge of how to dismantle what they're tasked for, because they are revolutionary. So he understands that he's got all of these paradoxes that he has to somehow navigate. He's got people like Steve Bannon on one side telling him, you've got to go after the corporate class. You've got people on the other side, Elon Musk, saying, if you unleash this talent in Silicon Valley, we will have a rocket in Mars in 5 years. So it's going to be interesting to watch these tensions, how they play out.
You mentioned calling bluffs there. I mean, one of my thoughts about Trump on the world stage from 2016 to 2020 is that he did quite a lot of heavy bluffing and he got away with it to a large extent. I suppose the obvious question is, can he do that again? I mean, as you suggested there, at some point his bluff will get called and he'll have to act.
Well, you're right that he did do a lot of bluffing. My button is bigger than yours, he said to North Korea, and he said to NATO, I won't defend you unless you meet your obligations. But what made him effective the first term is that he actually did some things. So what do I mean by that? He killed Baghdadi, the ISIS head. He said he was going to bomb the SH. He did. And then he deliberately targeted him. He deliberately killed Soleimani. People had told him in the intelligence community that if you kill Soleimani, Iran will attack Israel. He did it anyway. People had accused him of Russian collusion. He went into Syria, and I don't think any president in the 70 years of the Cold War had killed 240 Russians, as he did with the Wagner Group. He bombed them when they attacked an installation. He told Putin he was getting out of a long-term missile treaty, which he felt was unfavorable to the West in general and us in particular. He slapped on sanctions on oligarchs. He flooded the world with cheap oil. He said when he came in, he lifted the arms embargo on offensive weapons. People forget that, to Ukraine, on javelins, for example. When he left office, of course, Biden, the first thing he did was reinstitute that weapons ban on offensive weapons. So he, at times, he felt that he had to act decisively. Now, in his defense, or may, I don't want to say his defense, but in a scenario that might make restoring deterrence a little bit easier is Israel. People had said a year ago, Israel can't touch Hezbollah. They killed Americans in 1983. They're 100,000 strong. There's like Nazi stormtroopers. They're indomitable. They destroyed Hamas, Hezbollah, for all practical purposes, for at least 4 or 5 years. They said, if you get in a tit for tat for of Iran, they have the most sophisticated Russian anti-ballistic missile systems. It won't be good for Israel. Israel destroyed those, and at any time it wants to, it can probably take out its nuclear facility. Just a matter of when and if, and the repercussions politically. They've dismantled Hamas to being really inert. They're doing the same thing with the Houthis. So he's coming into office with a surrogate that has done things that have restored Western deterrence. And you could say that Israel has never been, Israel and maybe Turkey as well, and that'll be problematic, but radical Islam or Iranian sponsored terrorism has never been at this nadir. It never has. And the previous administrations, remember, their plan for the Middle East under Obama, Ben Rhodes, and carried on to Biden was, we are going to empower an alternate nexus, a Shia Persian underdog, the people who've been victimized by the Sunni corrupt majority. And we'll have an axis in Tehran, Beirut, Damascus, the West Bank and Gaza. And that will create what they called creative tension between our old allies, the Gulf monarchies, Egypt, Jordan, and Israel, and these new ascendant groups that have different religion and a different political. And we will stand back and adjudicate. We won't get trapped helping Israel or committed to unpopular positions. And Trump blew that up, and Israel blew that up too, and it's non-existent now. Biden tried to resurrect it with it begging to get back in the Iran deal, lifting sanctions, paying $6 billion to Iran for hostages, releasing impounded money, restraining Israel for a long time, putting an arms embargo on heavy bombs. But it's gone. And so there are avenues of opportunity. And I think the same thing holds true with Ukraine. It's not like Russia tried to decapitate Kiev. There was a heroic defense. It's 1.6, 1.5 million total dead, wounded, and missing on both sides. The greatest loss of life in Europe since Stalingrad. And so everybody wants that war over, and no one knows how to do it. And I think Trump will come in and try to implement what everybody's talking about secretly, stealthily, but they don't want to say publicly, and that is some type of instituting the theft of Crimea and Donbass for Putin, seeing they can get him back to where he was in 2022, arming Ukraine but not putting it in NATO. Something like that is what I hear that he's trying to angle for.
An earlier guest on this podcast, Charlie Gammel, was suggesting that Khamenei's been meant to die for some time now, but he may be pretty close to dying. And it would be very sort of Trumpy luck if he were to die at around the time Trump is inaugurated. How do you think Trump could seize that opportunity? I mean, one possible scenario is that he ends up going to Tehran in some sort of dramatic attempt to influence the way Iran looks at the world.
Well, I think that might have been, in the case of Iran, that might have been a strategic gambit prior to October 7th. But I think the consensus in the United States and in Israel is that Iran now is revealed to be a paper tiger. Everybody thought that it had these sophisticated defenses. It shot 500 projectiles of various sorts into Israel on two occasions. I think seven got through, did no damage. Israel replied and has basically destroyed its entire fuel depots for missile attacks. Their inventory is shrinking. Hezbollah has no avenue to be rearmed now that Syria's lost. Its whole apparatus, maybe 4,000 are wounded or killed. Hezbollah, then I think, is really not the terrible threat that every Westerner was afraid of. Hamas is, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's not an active terrorist organization right now. So I think the more likely scenario is Trump is going to tell the Iranians, we want you to let in inspectors and let us see that you are not going, you're not using this fissionable material to make a bomb or missile. And if they refuse, I think he's going to tell, and I don't have any inside information, but I imagine from what I read, he's going to say something like the following. Mr. Netanyahu, I don't really want to tell you what to do, but you're free to do whatever you want. And our role will be twofold, one to supply the necessary munitions and the other to tell Turkey, North Korea, but especially China and Russia, that it's none of their business what you do. And I think there's a 50-50 chance that Israel will have a preemptive strike. Whether it'll be effective, I don't know. Whether it'll depend on what their intelligence says about the number, if any, of nuclear weapons that Iran already has.
I take your point about Iran being revealed to be a paper tiger, but I mean, it's still a substantial power. I mean, it's a country of 90 million people. Its economy has been badly harmed in recent years, but it has huge natural resources. It has a very, very intelligent, high IQ population.
That's one of the reasons that it's very fragile. Reports that we're getting in the United States was this week, they essentially ran out of natural gas, one of the greatest natural gas reserves in the world, and people have no heat. And that's very dangerous, as you know, when you have an upwardly mobile, very educated and traditionally aware population like the Iranians. The regime is unpopular. There's news accounts of the amount of material. It's almost comparable to what we lost in Afghanistan, that which outraged the American people. But the idea that if you total up the arsenals of Hamas, Hezbollah, and Syria over 10 or 20 years, it could be up to $30 or $40 billion in missiles and weapons and shells that are completely gone now. And so I think the people who are suffering economically and they see all of this money, it's one thing to spend it and disagree with how it's being spent. If you're an aware Iranian citizen, you say, I don't like the theocracy, but at least we're ascendant and people fear us now. And so I don't like their methods. I don't like what they're doing, but at least all of these things have made an impression on people that belittled us. But when you make that type of sacrifice and investment and all of your tentacles have been chopped off and you look like you're incompetent and weak, and then you're theocratic and backward in the eyes of the middle class, then I don't think they're very stable at all. And I think they're terrified right now. And I think right now what Iran is doing, they're looking at the United States and they're saying, well, we had people in the Pentagon, we had people in the State Department, we had people in the Washington nexus that were very sympathetic to us, especially the second round of immigrants that came after the Shah fell, the Bonnie Sauter people, goat's body people. They came to the United States in 83 and 84, committed socialists, and they were disappointed when Khomeini revealed his true nature to them. So there are people in the United States that are very pro-Iranian, and they have a great deal of influence on past and previous foreign policy, and now they have no influence. They're being rooted out of all the appointments. The 20 or 25,000 political appointments that go from the Pentagon to the DOJ to the Department of Homeland Security, CIA, they are being systematically replaced. after January 3rd. And that didn't happen in 2017. So I think Iran looks and says that we have no sympathetic audience in the United States. Our small expatriate but sympathetic people who were of high status and influence in the Obama and Biden are gone. Trump is completely unpredictable. We have no idea what he's going to do when he talks about rearming the United States, standing by his friends, punishing his enemies. No better friend, no worse enemy. This doesn't look good for us. So I think they'll react either two ways. They'll accelerate getting a nuclear weapon very quickly, or they will keep very, very quiet.
Hmm. Well, I think Middle East will be one of the most fascinating aspects of Trump 2.0. But I wonder, you were talking earlier about those appointments that have been sent in. So Kash Patel, FBI, Tulsi Gabbard, Director of Intelligence, Pete Hegseth at Defense, obviously. Not Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, but Pam Bondi is also an interesting appointment.
Matt Gaetz, I don't know what that was. People have argued it was a sacrificial pawn to direct the animus of the... I don't know if it's that Machiavellian. I think it was just a disaster from A to Z.
but I think, Pam Bondi, it will be interesting too, because if you think about all those appointments, the one area where really that could be the most explosive is an attempt to fight what we've been calling lawfare. That is where the deep state, for want of a better term, that is where you'll get the biggest reaction possibly. What do you think?
Yeah, that'll be interesting because what's going on in the United States right now in the left-wing media and in the so-called administrative state universities is something like the following. They are projecting onto Trump, and they think like this. If I were Donald Trump and I had suffered what we did to him, and I was now back in power, I know what I would do to me. And I'm not sure that's an accurate reading of him. He said the other day, I give first, second, and third chances, but not fourth chances. So somebody who was really detrimental to him, say Steve Bannon, who talked terribly about him to the New Yorker, I think it was, he's back in good graces. And there's Marco Rubio had a whole website in 2016 about the bankruptcies that you want to bankrupt. He's Secretary of State. J.D. Vance called him a Hitler-like figure. So he doesn't really hold a grudge. He's a transactional, operational person. So I think he's going to tell people, if you find activity that was wrong or illegal, investigate it, but don't start with the crime and then find the person in Berea fashion. So I think that's a big difference. I do think he's going to do things that are way overdue. And I'll just give you two minor examples. He has the ability to stop national security clearances for ex-CIA and intelligence officials. So when you have 51 intelligence authorities who on the eve of an election deliberately lie, and they know it was a lie because the FBI had the laptop in their possession and had signaled that it was authentic, but they wouldn't release it. But when they not only lied, but the agencies were working with Facebook and Twitter to suppress that accurate story in the New York Post, and they all have security clearances, and they're all unrepentant, say a Leon Panetta, former CIA director, James Clapper, former director of national intelligence, John Brennan, and they cooked this up to influence an election. And we had one poll that said after the election that it affected 5 to 8% of the population. Well, why would you continue to give those people security clearances so they go on MSNBC and CNN and wink and nod and say, my sources tell me, why they fabricate another misadventure? Or why would you, if Article 88 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice says no active or retired general, admiral subject to recall shall disparage the commander-in-chief, and you had people calling Donald Trump in 2017, 18, 19. He's Hitler, quoting directly now, Mussolini, architect of Auschwitz, pathological liar, should be removed as quickly as possible. The sooner the better. And we just had Mark Milley say that Donald Trump was a fascist and his supporters are fascists. And then he understands what's going on. So as soon as Donald Trump won the election, this invective was used to diminish his candidacy. And he knows what Trump is going to do and enforce Article 88. He says, I don't really believe that he's a fascist. I was just hyperbolic. So he can easily do that. He can say to all of these retired officers, you're not going to continue to disparage not just me, but any president in the future, because we do indict and we do prosecute and we do convict and jail corporals, majors, anyone who publicly blasts the president of the United States or his cabinet. And we're going to apply that to you. So what I'm getting at, there's a lot of bureaucratic things below the radar that have been just egregious. And I think he's going to set a tone, a deterrent tone, to stop that. And that will be a good thing, I think. I think that's much more likely than going back and saying, well, John Brennan lied twice under oath 7 years ago to Congress, 8 years ago to Congress. And James Clapper not only lied under oath, but he said he gave the least untruthful answer. Let's see if we can get around the statute of limitations and the way they went around it for me. I don't think he's going to do that. I really don't.
I suppose the degree of success that he might have is down to the opposition. I think it's fair to say that the opposition have, to a large extent, rolled over. Joe Biden is kind of vanishing without a trace. Kamala Harris gives the odd embarrassing speech now. The Democrats sort of look as though they seem to be in for a period of soul searching. And a lot of the big tech overlords, you know, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Sam Altman, these people who were fairly critical of Trump before, fairly critical publicly and very opposed in the way their businesses behaved, they are all donating to the presidential inaugural fund. They appear to have accepted the reality of Trump 2.0.
Yeah, I think I'd somewhat, you just described up, there was people in all sectors of America of all political persuasions that felt that that America had still an untapped potential, that it wasn't utilizing all of its resources, and it was almost suffering from a commissar system where we had enormous DEI overhead in the Pentagon, and that meant that if you announce in the Pentagon that your meritocratic basis for promotion is not fully operational, you're going to have DEI, and you say you're looking for white supremacy, white rage, white privilege, and you don't find any, and they didn't find any in the report, then you lose 45,000 recruits right off the bat who are not showing up. And the demographic data on them shows that they're almost all middle and lower middle class white males. And the further data shows that in our recent engagements in Afghanistan, Iraq, they died at double their numbers in their demographic. 75% of all the killed were white males of the middle and lower class. They only comprised 33% of the population. So it's things like that. And then you get people from Silicon Valley and they're not, I mean, they've already got the money, but they operate with basically trust and cartels, as we saw in 2020 in Molly Ball's seminal Time magazine, which was intended to praise it, how they tried to absorb the work of registrars and get a shift to mail and ballot. That was Mark Zuckerberg, for example. But I think they feel that they could do more things if the government didn't come in and say, we're going to pick eight AI companies, as Andreessen charged, that are going to be successful and the rest of them can't participate. So they feel that the regulations have got to such a point that they're becoming like the EU. And then there were people in the energy industry for all different, many of the corporate elite, maybe they had to, maybe they were left wing. And corporate funding for Joe Biden in 2020 was greater than for Donald Trump. But there are people in the energy sector that say, if you would let us do what we can do, we can supply all the natural gas for Europe. They don't have to worry about Putin, and we can make money. We can help the Canadians. We can import all, we can rebuild Keystone. Don't worry about the Chinese embargoes on precious strategic minerals. We have more in the Tehachapi area and up in the Dakotas and Wyoming than they ever had. So, and then the same thing about the universities. Just forget Claudine Gay and all these people. All you have to do is very simple things. Just tell these people to enforce the First Amendment, tax some of these huge endowments, the income on the endowments, say anything over $2 or $3 billion, and to remind them that they are supposed to be nonprofit organizations. They won't have enough, starve the beast, so they don't have money to fund this anti-Western, anti-humanitarian DEI curriculum. So there's people from all sides that are saying, I think it's a period where anything is possible. And when you look at that, I think emblematic was that rocket of Elon Musk. And we were told in America that our ancestors built the Saturn V. It was the most powerful rocket, the greatest thrust, the greatest height that we'd ever seen. We won the space race. It powered every moon shot, nothing like it. And then we stopped. We haven't gone to the moon. We don't know how to make it anymore. I think we have two around somewhere. One's in a museum, one's inert. And then this guy comes along and he says, I can add 40 feet to the height of this historic thing. And I'm going to make it, you know, almost 400 feet tall. And by the way, I'll have an erector arm that will catch it on the way back. And everybody said, oh my God. Or this man comes along and says, no one has ever broken into the big three. It's impossible. GM, Ford, Chrysler have a monopoly. I'm going to come in, and all of a sudden, Tesla is the best-selling car in California. So there's a sense that these people, everybody, wants to be turned loose. And that, I mean, that happened for a moment during the Reagan administration. There was excess, as there always is when people make money and they get powerful. But there's at least an animal urge that everybody should step up now. And you really can do, if you think if there are 50,000 felons that came in illegal from New York, don't worry about whether it's polite or not. Get them back out of the country. They're felons, they're convicted criminals. You don't have to worry about what the New York Times says about you anymore. Joe Rogan has 70 million people sometimes. So why would you worry about what they say? Don't worry about the racist diatribes of Joy Reid. She's got 500,000 listeners. You can go on to Dan Bongino and get that many, you know, in 10 minutes. So there's a new media, there's a new culture, and I think that's one of the things that Trump's campaign was all about. He was outspent $2.5 billion to $1 billion, if you look at the PAC money, and yet it didn't matter. It's how you use the money. You know, he didn't rent private jets. He didn't pay Al Sharpton or Cardi B money to endorse him. He went to all these podcasters that had these huge audiences. He was able to make fun of the garbage truck stunt, the McDonald's stunt. It's this idea that the president is not some lofty, removed figure, that he trolls people, that he laughs, that 6 months ago, athletes were still taking a knee. Now they're doing the YMCA dance after they make a touchdown. It's just a different mood for a while. It's a cultural counter-revolution, but it's also an upbeat that we can speak freely now on the university. You can be a speaker, and if somebody shouts you down like they did Judge Duncan at my university, they hijacked his lecture at the law school. They said they wanted to rape his daughter. They canceled it. One of the administrators took over. I think if Judge Duncan were to come back to Stanford Law School, he would get a completely polite and peaceful. And I can just give you one other example of the difference. I would walk across campus, and for 4 months you had a Hamas camp, and they were really yelling eliminationist rhetoric. Jews, River of the Sea. Statute said that nobody could camp out one night on Stanford campus in the free speech. Each president administrator was terrified. Trump is elected. He's not even in office. He's announced that if people violate civil codes or criminal codes and they're here on a student visa, they will get their wish and get to go back home. That's all he said. The university presidents then, people of the left, have echoed that because it's in their interest. They don't want this mess. Their office were trashed. The president's office was trashed by demonstrators. Historic colonnades were smeared with paint. They couldn't get out. So secretly, they can't admit that, but they want to return to normality. So you walk across campus, there's not a single tent. And the reason is not because they feel that Israel has reformed itself or they suddenly like the United States, but as guests here, they know that it's not normal and it wouldn't be tolerated in polite society, in the private sector and other countries, for you to be a guest and come over here and violate the laws of your host and then do it defiantly and insult your host. It's just not a normal situation. So now people say, we have the power of popular opinion and Donald Trump, and we're going to tell them if you occupy the Manhattan Bridge or the Bay Bridge and you shut down traffic and you stop emergency vehicles, you harm the public health, we will give you your wish. We will convict you and you can go back to Egypt and do it. Or you can go back to Syria or Iraq or Gaza. And that sounds like a punitive medieval idea, but actually when you think about it, it's more, we're worried about the average person that has to drive on the bridge. We're worried about the student that saved, his parents saved up money, sent him to Stanford, and he has to tiptoe around people calling him a racist and all. So we're not going to do that anymore. And I think it's resonating with people. I never in my life thought that Donald Trump in some polls would be 7 to 8% higher than his disapproval rating. So he can be anywhere from 51 to 55 in some of them, some 49 to 42. It's hard to calibrate that. It doesn't make sense. Other than people feel there's a release and they can express themselves and we're going to get back to normality. I think it's a good thing for countries overseas. I think this return to sort of, and I just talked to a person yesterday who's a candidate for the National Endowment for Arts. This idea we're going to return to classical architecture and statuary when we give federal contracts for new buildings. We don't have to have these ugly buildings or representational art or a banana stuck on a wall that's $6 million. And so I think there's people coming out of the woodwork and saying, you know, I was always afraid and these people dominate it, but now I see it was just a small minority. And even the institutions they said would hurt me, they're ossified or calcified. I don't really care if somebody on NBC or the Washington Post attacks me. I have other alternatives. There are people that on our side, there's a new Twitter. Everybody said he was stupid to pay $44 billion. Maybe it was smart what Elon Musk did. That's what the kind of mood is right now. And I think in Europe, and especially Britain and the English-speaking peoples, the message is, you may not like us. You may see that this is your Greek philosophers and we're Roman legionnaires or whatever you see us, but it's actually very good for you because we represent your values and we consider you part, not just part, but the founders of our culture and our civilization. I know we have large minorities that are anti-Western, but they themselves want to be Western and they are Western. Then we're going to remind them they're Western. That's why they're here. And we're going to protect our interests. So everybody says I guarantee you, if Vladimir Putin were to go into another country that was a member of NATO for all of his barking, Trump would do things that Biden would not. That's what's so ironic about this, that people think Biden was an institutionalist. Biden said to Zelensky, we'll fly you out there. We'll fly you out of there. He was the one that said, my reaction to Russia will depend on it's a major or minor invasion. We've had four prior in administration. There was only one that Putin did not leave his borders. That was during Trump. He went into Ossetia and Georgia under George W. Bush. He went into Donbass and Crimea under Biden. He tried to take Kiev under Biden as vice president and Obama's president. And as Biden as president, he went in Kiev. And Donald Trump, he didn't. I don't think it's because he liked Donald Trump. I don't think it was because he thought he admired Trump. I think he thought that Trump was entirely unpredictable. And even at this late date, America had the wherewithal to stop him. And it was a matter of confidence. So it is exciting. But, you know, the Reagan revolution was exciting and all. And the Nixon revolution, something will happen. I'm not a naive Pollyanna. There will be, the left is in a period of stasis. It's saying, it didn't work. The border, crime, foreign policy was a disaster. We know we have 30 more days on Biden's. Just take over. We're not going to invoke the Logan Act like we tried to destroy you last time. There is no Logan Act, even though you're not officially president, Mr. Trump, and you guys just take over. We're going to regroup and attack you in 2 months. But right now, we're out of ideas, we're out of power, and we're just depressed.
Yeah. From the way you describe it so eloquently, it feels as though there is life in the American dream yet.
I think so.
I suppose I should ask you, you mentioned that rocket being caught. That was probably one of the moments of the year. But what for you was the moment of 2024 that sums up what happened this year?
It was a weird moment. And I'm not trying to praise Donald Trump, but he was at the McDonald's. And of course, he was in a performance art apprentice fashion, trying to get free publicity and trying to remind people that he actually worked at McDonald's and Kamala Harris had not. And she was claiming that she was an ex-McDonald's with no evidence. But there was a point that was unscripted. An Indian American, a family from India, I don't know if you remember, drove up to the window. And he was talking to Trump, and he said, "I'm just an ordinary person." And Trump said, "You are not ordinary. No one is ordinary." And then his wife said, "You took a bullet for us, Mr. President." And you would think, being Trump, it would be braggadocious. But he kind of looked stunned, deer in the headlights, and he said, "I guess I did." And there was this sense that even Trump, it was sort of like he's got this attitude for the year. Well, wait a minute. They went after me in 5 criminal and civil suits, 91 indictments. They tried to get me off 16 ballots. I was the first president ever impeached twice during my tenure. They tried me as a private citizen. They called me Hitler to such a degree, they lowered the bar. We had 2 assassination near misses. And I survived them all. And I'm kind of a Nietzschean figure. They made me stronger. I'm at a place in my mind or life now that I've just got 4 years. I don't have to campaign. I will never have to do, or I never wanted to do, but whatever, I never will do another rally, probably, at least a campaign rally. There might be a rally just celebratory, but I think there's a sense that everybody is sort of exhausted. They're kind of happy. Fetterman the other day, the Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, said that he wants Trump to succeed in every dimension. We've had all these people that just say, you know, I'm tired. I know that if he screws up, they will come back with a passion, and there will be Russian collusion hoax and laptop disinformation hoax. But right now, he's sort of like that line in Shakespeare, you know, about Caesar. He strodes like a colossus above us, and we are pathetic people in our graves, that great line. And when he went into Notre Dame, that was another iconic moment. I thought, Mr. President, you don't have any business yet. You're not elected. And yet Macron wanted him there. And then you saw Jill Biden kind of almost wink at him with her husband absent. And then this atrocious orange hair, Queen's accent, ridiculous figure that Europeans loathe. They're fighting. And they didn't do that to him before. They were fighting to get his attention. And I guess, and touch him even, I thought. And the idea was, we don't want to admit it, but there's a chance that America will be strong again, and that will radiate and help us. And you are on our side. We know you are. Now, we're going to attack you and make fun of you and hope you fail. But for right now, we like the idea that America is going to be powerful again and on our side.
Well, I like that idea very much. Thank you very much, Victor Davis Hanson.
Thank you.
It's always wonderful to have you on Americano, and happy Christmas. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of The Americano Show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.